We look back with pride and gratitude on what has happened. We reflect upon the astonishing artistic achievement of Australians. We reflect, of course, on the astonishing sporting achievements of the men and women of Australia who represent us on the sporting fields with such great distinction.
And if you look at what, in terms of the policy of the Howard government over the last decade, the culture wars were not abstract theoretical debates. They were there, visible, very, very visible, on the ground in terms of the policy implemented through those various institutions, the appointments to various boards and committees, the government policy on Anzac Day, the funding of cash prizes for Anzac Day activities in schools, and so on and so on. I mean, citizenship, education debates. This culture war infiltrated every aspect of our political cultural policy. It's not abstract.
There is a school of history which ignores or trivialises all those parts of the past which can't be conscripted into glorifying a politically correct version of the present.
And it's also cruel to rob a generation of Australian children to steal from them a pride in their past that they can rightly feel.
But there is a tendency which I've referred to as minority fundamentalism.
Then you degenerate into the whole postmodernist worldview that that, you know, people can decide the truth among themselves.
Many of the ploys that have been used in Australia's culture wars and history wars have been adopted from American neoconservatives. The whole idea of elites, of the chattering classes, the attack on political correctness, all of those terms and ways of framing the argument are taken from American neoconservatives.
The standards got thrown up in the air like a piece of red meat to be yipped at and yowled at by the various dogs in the culture wars. So it became a media storm. It was quite remarkable, something that those of us who'd worked on these pretty carefully over 3 years were taken aback at. We I think, ran into a buzzsaw. That's how we saw it.
American historian Gary B. Nash, one of the authors of a set of national guidelines for the teaching of history in the United States. In late 1994, when this voluntary teaching guide was released, he and his two co-authors found themselves at the centre of a major furor after neoconservatives were outraged at the language and historical interpretation in the teaching guide. Leading the charge was one Lynn Cheney, former chairwoman of the powerful funding body, the National Endowment for the Humanities, who said that the standards presented a grim and gloomy portrayal of American history.
There are a wide range of people who each for their own reason came together in a repudiation of bourgeois middle American values. I think that I represent the reassertion of American exceptionalism. A nation that has said, okay, we've listened to all this junk, where you're supposed to know who your grandmother was, and that gets you extra points on the test. You know, this is a dangerous, racist, sexist country. Now, I can find you quote after quote and group after group across this country who said that.
Former U.S. Congressman Newt Gingrich, who, among other neocons, kept up a sustained attack on the U.S. national history standards. A committee of review was established, and after some minor reworking, the standards were finally released. And while some US states chose to write their own, the national history standards ultimately had widespread take-up among history teachers in the US. So what was it about the tenor and tone of the standards which led to such outrage from conservatives in the US? Gary B. Nash.
Well, there's no doubt, Michelle, that the approach of the teachers and the professional historians was that of those who feel that critical thinking is the key to an intelligent citizenry, and that it was much more important to be able to think about cause and effect or multiple perspectives on the past than to remember an exact date or name or place or event. Those on the right, conservatives generally, wanted a nuts and bolts history where they believed everything was largely agreed upon. and that the notion of interpreting history from different perspectives was offensive to them. The word revisionism, historical revisionism, that phrase was thrown about as a kind of sneering curse phrase. So revisionism itself became something under attack, historical scholarship, the idea that historians should disagree and debate, that became an offensive, at least that was seemed to be a marketable argument.
Too often history has fallen victim in an ever more crowded curriculum to subjects deemed more relevant to today. Too often it is taught without any sense of structured narrative, replaced by a fragmented stew of themes and issues.
Early in 2006, then Prime Minister John Howard used his Australia Day speech to launch his own assault on the teaching of Australian history in schools. He called for root and branch renewal, for the return to narrative and chronology, and soon his Education Minister, Julie Bishop, was warning that history teaching was in danger of being manipulated by political agendas. By August of that year, the government had hosted a history summit, which brought together 23 historians, educators and public commentators. Within a year of the summit, a set of recommendations for the teaching of history had been written, apparently then ditched and rewritten. And the original steering group, which had gathered at the summit, had been reduced to a four-person reference group, two of whom were historians, one being Geoffrey Blainey. There was also a teaching guide for years 9 and 10, which begins with Indigenous Australia's early encounters with Europeans and ends with the 2000 Olympics in Sydney.
When the History Summit was taken up, I think that we hoped that there would be agreement. Yes, the History Summit had a skewed membership. There were a number of conservatives who seemed to be there principally because they were conservatives, but there were a number of highly reputable historians and people who meant well for history. Yes, someone who'd played a role in the history wars was commissioned to write one of the papers and made recommendations for a curriculum that wasn't so much, I think, ideological as inappropriate and overambitious. But the summit agreed that it was possible to work out an approach on which there would be broad agreement. And that was then done. The difficulty was that the Prime Minister didn't like it and said he wouldn't accept it. So that, and furthermore, throughout this period, you had the persistent attacks on the teaching profession by the minister and on occasion by the prime minister. So the opportunities, I think, were frittered away in a series of sort of partisan and unnecessary attempts to make mileage out of it.
It was refreshing to have a government want to have a summit about history. That was remarkably brave for Howard. He was a prime minister who actually took history seriously. And we would also agree with him that it's important for historians to insert into their versions of the past real people, real characters, real agents of social change and social history. But what they don't and can't ever agree is exactly which characters, which events, which processes will always be important to us.
And I believe that it will provide a comprehensive set of signposts, milestones for the teaching of Australian history.
I think the difficulty about well-meaning people who want to suggest that, you know, people should be taught the facts is that they confuse memorisation of historical data with historical understanding. And clearly historical understanding requires knowledge, but the knowledge comes from the engagement with the subject and the attempt to interpret it and understand it. You're much more likely to know that Edmund Barton was the first Prime Minister if you've really got interested in the making of the Commonwealth than if you're told you have to memorise it.
We start off with Federation and move through the wars, the Depression, to basically now. And so the wars are pretty interesting. They're quite good, but the Federation, you do often end up falling asleep and it's quite boring.
It's just more interesting. It has more to do with the rest of the world and how Australia fits in with it.
Well, yeah, it's good to know about where you're from, but when Australia doesn't have much of a history, you know, there's not much to learn.
When you look at all the other countries and all the other history they have, it's far more interesting. You've got Rome, you've got samurai, you know, you've got civil wars. But Australia, you've got Federation.
actually, people in our class don't like it that much. I'm like one of the only people that do. But I think that it is important to learn about your country's history.
There's a lot of note-taking, which can get a bit tedious. But the wars are good. So more war in Australian history would be good.
You know, there are many reasons beyond simply nationalism that makes military history interesting. It's also its international component, where Australia's actually out there in the world for the, you know, some of the only times in Australian history, and kids are really fascinated with a kind of global context like that.
That's historian Anna Clark, who's collected 250 interviews with school students, teachers and education professionals about their attitudes to Australian history. Her book, History's Children, has just been released, and it offers a real insight into why and how school students might end up loving or loathing Australian history. And she has some doubts as well about the new guide for the teaching of history in years 9 and 10.
The students that I talked with, and the teachers as well, but, you know, particularly the students, it might have turned them off history even more, because the last thing they want is to be writing down endless facts and dates and rote learning and writing notes off the boards and looking at overheads. They want to do it. They want to debate, you know, the apology in class in a sensitive way, in a knowledgeable way, mm. and knowing certain facts about it. But they do actually want to take part in these historical discussions, because history isn't just what happened. It's something that's around us all the time, and it's something we do, and it requires a number of skills. And if you're just filling up the lesson with content, you're never going to be able to learn those skills. Like, how do you deal with the fact that the Anzac legend has changed over time?
The spirit bequeathed by Alec and his generation, though born of war's adversity, still slumbers within our people, ready to rise and draw new breath when disaster strikes or danger threatens. An essence that continues to define our nation's identity.
I think one of the key dangers is that because Anzac is taking up increasing space in our national memory, if you like, that we have less space for the history of Aboriginal people. We have less space for our political history. We have less space for our democratic history. We buy the myth of 1915 at the expense, perhaps, of understanding many of the other ways in which Australia did truly become a nation.
Historian Mark McKenna, who last year wrote an essay about the use and abuse of the Anzac legend by politicians, most prominently former Prime Minister John Howard. McKenna argues that the Anzac legend was increasingly invoked by the Howard government after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and that this concentration on Australia's military history came at the expense of other aspects of the country's history, those which might not necessarily engender sentiments such as pride and patriotism.
If you look at Peter Costello's statements, if you look at Alexander Downer's statements, if you look at John Howard's statements, both in Iraq and in Australia, on talkback radio, especially all three of those, you know, leading politicians from the Howard era, you'll find that they explicitly say that what our boys are doing in Iraq is no different to what we were doing on the beaches of Anzac Cove in 1915. Now, that is an example, okay, on a very superficial level, it's an example of political exploitation and politicians trying to cash in on a national myth. Okay, that's not unusual. But it is very worrying from the point of view of its complete disregard for history. It's a complete disregard for the history of the event, which was very much rooted in an imperial campaign and was not about us. And that, I think, links into other questions that, for me, a lot of the new embrace of Anzac Day is an attempt, in a way, to inflate our image of ourselves on the back of the memory of the deaths of those men at Anzac Cove in 1915.
Our nation pledges itself once more to an ethos of selflessness and shared determination, courage and compassion. We signal our understanding that the freedom under which we shelter needs to be nurtured and at times defended anew. We think of the men and women of the Australian Defence Force, now serving in Afghanistan and elsewhere.
Then a lot of people didn't get it when Billy Hughes put on a slouch hat for the 1919 election. You can go a long way with that sort of military stance.
What it's about is elevating a myth to the level of an article of faith. And it's through that article of faith that we bond as a national community. So it's a way of providing national communion, if you like. Once it gets to that level, it's no longer really about a critical appraisal of the history. Mm. That gets completely lost.
John Howard, I think, did that very effectively, actually. I think his use of the Anzac legend to build bridges between what is a proud military tradition and a more vernacular form of Australianism, I think he did it extremely effectively. In his eulogy for the last World War One digger, Alec Campbell, I think in other instances of his speech-making around Anzac Day, his references to the war in Iraq, I think he actually did that extremely effectively, trod that path between telling a story of so-called Australianness, of all those kind of images of blinding loyalty to your mates, the digger image, if you like, and build a bridge between that and what contemporary mateship was all about. It's attracted criticism, including by historian commentators, but I must say I think he did it more effectively than some people would give him credit for.
It's got different aspects to it that I think are probably misunderstood if we think that it's a glorification of war. When I was at primary school, our headmaster was an Anzac veteran, and we were told that the Turk was not to be trusted under any circumstances. It's become a story which has, in a sense, been loosened from its historical moorings and been given new values by people who I think are looking for people to admire and find something admirable in that willingness to go around halfway around the world and risk and give your life.
I find Anzac Day is personally really interesting because, one of my grandfather fought for Australia in World War II, and I have a lot of the stories that he wrote and feel quite kind of devoted to what he did. And I'm unashamed to sort of say that, you know, I have a bit of a tear in my eye if I'm watching a dawn service or if I watch Gallipoli or so on. It really pulls certain strings. But at the same time, the little academic voice in my head is critiquing this nationalism. And so it was really interesting as an interviewer, as an academic interviewer, going and speaking to kids and teachers and hearing them talk about Anzac Day. And for many of them, it was an uncritical appreciation of Australian national identity. And it was really a belief in sort of having positive images of Australia and so on. And to sit there as an interviewer and feel slightly uncomfortable about certain things that were sort of said, like the sort of almost blind love of Gallipoli that some female students I spoke with showed, without really sort of thinking about the wider historical context and so on. But at the same time, it was really important to do that because it gave me an appreciation of the fact that these aren't simply political devices. They're deeply held personal views by people. And this is why the history wars are so contested, because people's attachment to their national past, which is a collective past, is paradoxically very personal.
I mean, I think that it's no coincidence, for example, that if you look at the debate around values in particular and the importance of history to national identity, post-September 11, you'll find in Britain, in Japan, in Germany, in Australia, in many, many countries, you will find an anxiety that in a way has been created by the uncertain international environment. So it's possible to see that in some ways this more conservative embrace of national history is itself a response to this increased international environment of threat and uncertainty.
But it's one of the paradoxes of our time, isn't it, that we live in an era of globalisation. The nation state carries less authority than it has at any time over the last 100 years. And there are various forms of compensation. The history wars arise from that very fact, I think, that the great historical transformations of our period, the freeing of the economy, free trade, have thrown great movements of people across borders in ways that have become very threatening. And to some extent, the history wars are a reaction against movements set in train by the very interests that fight the history wars.
You've been listening to Hindsight and the third program in the series History Under Siege.